you probably won't find a movie which will give you as accurate a sense of what it might be like if, you know, someone like you or I, who's not a hardened criminal, sets about trying to plan a robbery. You know, when we were shooting the movie, we had a kind of phrase was, you know, in their minds it was going to be Ocean's 11, and in reality it was like Dog Day Afternoon or something.
You see? I knew you were the man for this. Look at him. He's like a fish in water.
Sure. Let's just walk in there in broad daylight and rob the place. Oh, yeah, while you're at it, you're going to dynamite the canteen, right?
How many cameras did you say were in the special collections? Because they're going to be watching everything from the campus safety office, the cameras, the alarms. They're going to know who's coming in. What are you doing?
I'm taking notes.
Why don't you just email the FBI and ask them where they'd like us to leave our fingerprints? You can make it easy for them. Guys, we need to find out who's watching the special collections room and when.
I concur with that.
Hi, I'm Bart Layton. I'm the writer and director of both The Imposter and this new movie, American Animals. Definitely, the less you know, the better the experience, probably. But essentially, it's the story of one of the most audacious art thefts in modern American history. It's perpetrated by an unusual group of kind of wannabe criminals who are university students at one of the oldest colleges in America. And they discover that in the university library is a special collections museum. And in that room are housed some of the most valuable books in the world, including a first edition of Darwin's Origin of the Species, and then these extraordinary works of art called Birds of America, which were by John James Audubon, and they had a value in the tens of millions. And they sort of fantasize about, you know, could they plan the perfect robbery? And the more they plan it, the more they realize that they could probably get away with it. And the more they begin to think about it, the more it becomes a sort of existential question. They sort of get to this crossroads where they figure that if they go through with it, the one thing that's guaranteed is that nothing will ever be the same again. And if they don't go through with it, they are looking at a life of what they see as a sort of series of fairly predictable outcomes. You know, they're fairly well educated, they come from good families, you know, they, you know, I've spent time in that town. It's fairly sanitized, but it looks a lot like what the American dream is supposed to look, you know, beautiful homes and manicured lawns and all the rest of it. But for these young men, they're sort of desperately searching for an identity. I guess it's about a bad idea that goes way too far. It's also, I guess, about the motivation. You know, it's about this pressure to leave a mark on the world, to lead a so-called interesting life. And that's something which is a big part of what's driving their behavior, I think. It's sort of like an existential heist movie. I hope that there's a form to the movie which people won't have seen before. It's definitely not a documentary, but there are non-fiction elements. You know, the real guys who committed the crime are in the movie alongside these very brilliant young actors who play them. And I think people won't have seen that before. And I hope that the effect of it is what was intended, which is that your emotional investment in the story and in the characters is heightened because of it, that you are able to, I guess, you know, one of the things for me as a filmmaker is that, you know, I want to encourage audiences to participate rather than just to watch. You know, I think there's a lot of movies you go and see and they're hugely enjoyable, but you're kind of watching and observing. You're not really participating. You don't feel your heart rate start to climb. You don't feel like you are playing along in quite the same way. And I think with this, you know, people feel it intensely. It's a really big emotional roller coaster that people go on. And, you know, it hopefully delivers on the tropes and the things that we all demand from a great heist movie. You know, we want all of those things. And in a way, that was part of what these guys were doing. You know, they didn't have any, they weren't practiced criminals. They didn't know how you go about committing a robbery. So they went to Blockbusters and rented every heist movie that they could find. You know, if they bothered to watch them to the end, they probably would have realized that they all end pretty badly.
Names first. Eric, Mr. Black. Spencer, Mr. Green. Mr. Yellow is me. Chaz, Mr. Pink.
Really, dude?
What?
You're making me Mr. Pink?
What? What's wrong, Mr. Pink?
You know exactly what's wrong with Mr. Pink, okay? I'm sorry, can I just say how dumb this entire thing is, okay? Because in the motion picture, the whole point of the names was so that nobody knew what the others were called, so they couldn't give each other up.
Relax, okay? It's just protocol so we don't address each other by our names during the robbery. Okay? Mm-hmm. No names, Mr. Pink.
It's so ridiculous, man.
And they all die in the end of that movie.
So I found the story in a magazine. I was on a flight between New York and London and just started reading about this bizarre story of this really kind of ill-advised robbery. And the more I read about it, the more bizarre it became, not least the fact that it was perpetrated by these young guys who, you know, they weren't, they had never committed any kind of criminal act before. They were from, you know, pretty good families, had plenty of opportunity. Were the, I guess, the last people that should have been involved in a crime like this. And that, in and of itself, was sort of enough for me to think, or to try and want to know more of the why of it. You know, like, what was it? Because the more I read about it, the more unlikely it seemed that they ever could have thought they'd get away with it. And if they did think they would get away with it, what did they imagine they were going to do with the artwork? What did they think they were going to do with the money? How were they going to, you know, it all felt deeply misguided and ill thought out, but it was intriguing enough to want to try and understand more. And so I wrote to them. At that point, they were halfway into quite what ended up being quite a long prison sentence. And so I wrote to them in prison and just sort of said, look, you know, my background is in documentary. I'm intrigued by the story, and I'd love to hear in your words a bit more about, you know, why you thought this was a good idea, and did you ever think it was going to kind of end well? And a lot of the things that they wrote in their letters from prison, each of them had a different motivation for the why of it. You know, one of them talked about being desperate to become an artist and feeling like, you know, all of the great artists that he'd ever read about, the one thing they all had in common was that they'd suffered a great deal. You know, they'd had pretty traumatic lives and childhoods filled with difficulty and tragedy. And he was looking at his own life and looking at how, I guess, there was no prospect of anything traumatic happening, and thinking to himself, well, what am I ever going to have to make art about? What am I ever going to have to say? What story am I ever going to have to tell? And so that idea of a kind of a central protagonist whose main problem is that he doesn't have a problem seemed like a kind of quintessentially modern idea, you know, and a sort of quite a relevant problem, you know, like it's a deeply first world problem, isn't it? That you don't have enough to complain about. You don't have enough trauma that's going to give you a story to tell or give you a voice. And so the idea that he then goes out to manufacture a kind of disaster in order to have something that's going to give him a voice or give him something to make art about seemed like an amazing starting point for a story and for a character. And each of them described different motivations. You know, one of them talked about having been brought up with this expectation that, you know, his life was going to be interesting and that he was going to be important and, you know, noteworthy in some way or remarkable. And then that gradual realization as you get into adulthood that probably those promises aren't going to come true necessarily, and that most of us are going to be average, and not wishing, you know, not being ready to settle for a mediocre life. You know, all of those ideas seemed like such an unusual motivation for this crime, but also deeply relevant. And I guess the more young people I've spoken to since the movie's come out who relate to that so deeply, you know, the pressure to be interesting and to be important. You know, I was being interviewed by a college journalist in Seattle recently, and one of the things she said that really stuck with me was that, you know, her friends and her, you know, they'd seen the movie and felt it was so kind of pertinent to them because they're all, you know, she said there's a sense amongst her and her peers that if they don't have a Wikipedia page written about them by the time they're 40, will that mean that they're not successful in any way?
Look, all I'm saying is that nothing will happen unless you make something happen. We're supposed to be hunter-gatherers, man. And our whole lives are just packaging, packaging, packaging. The illusion of choice. It's bullshit, man. Everyone in here thinks that they're gonna win the lottery, but no one buys a ticket.
Well, yeah, a prison would be a nice change of scenery.
Well, what about ending up on a boat in the Caribbean at the end of Shawshank Redemption?
Oh, my God.
What about that?
They'd been in prison for 20 years. And sorry to burst your bubble, but it doesn't work like that in real life, Warren. Bad guys, they don't get to ride off into the sunset with the money and the gold and,
How would we be the bad guys?
We'd be the robbers.
Aren't you even curious, your little brain, to find out what would actually happen? Aren't you curious?
Find out what?
To find out what would really happen in real life.
I guess there was something about this idea of trying to inhabit a movie version of your life because the reality seems too ordinary. That felt like it presented the possibility of finding a new way of telling a true story. You know, my background is in documentaries, and, you know, if you watch a doc, especially in the cinema, you know, it is really... you know, people's emotional engagement because of the fact that it's true and it's real and you're not being asked to suspend disbelief. You're not kind of in movie world where you know that it's a bunch of actors and that it's sort of, you know, the consequences don't really need to affect you in the same way. You know, I guess what I was struck by was that idea that if I was successful in this slightly weird kind of hybrid form, you could potentially get some of what a documentary can give you in terms of that kind of skin in the game type thing. You know, you have an emotional investment because it's real. This, what you're watching happened in the same world that you and I live in, right? It's not movie world. But at the same time, we're sort of pulling the curtain back a little bit on how movies or how stories get fictionalized, how movies based on true stories get embellished and all the rest of it. And so there are moments in the movie where not only do we question the validity of these events, but, you know, we question whether the narrators are reliable, but also that idea that memory is not terribly reliable. You know, there are moments where, you know, the same people who were present at the same exact incident remember it very differently. And so instead of choosing one over the other, we dramatize both of them. And we, I guess, are, again, we're inviting the audience to sort of understand the process of, you know, how these stories get fictionalized or misremembered. And, the really interesting thing is that in my experience, you know, when you show real people their stories dramatized, those dramatic scenes end up replacing their memories of what actually happened. So there is this weird thing where memory gets sort of corrupted over time, and we like to think of it as this quite accurate document of things that we've seen and experienced. And the truth is, it's not. It starts to disintegrate pretty fast. And again, can be replaced by the retelling of a story. You know, if you retell a story and you add details to it to make it more kind of interesting or dramatic, over time, those embellishments end up kind of being part of your memory and replacing, you know, the actuality of what happened. And I suppose, you know, we look at that in the movie, and if someone pulls out a gun in a documentary, you know, that is a really heart-stopping moment. You know, if someone's bleeding in a documentary, it's very different from if that's happening in a fiction film, because, you know, we're so familiar, you know, people get shot in the face every 5 minutes. Whereas with this, because you're constantly reminded of the truth of it and the reality, we end up creating something where your emotional investment in both the characters and the story is elevated. I mean, there's a whole other conversation to be had about, you know, the nature of truth in documentaries and all the rest of it. I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, we're trying to do here is be pretty open about how truth can get lost in the retelling and the misremembering or fictionalizing of a story. And I think, you know, with this, my intention was to stay as close to the truth and the facts as possible. But given that you're relying on the memories of people who were there, you know, how accurate can those ever be? You know, I showed all of the people involved with the story, the film, and they all felt that it was very accurate and reflective of the experiences they remembered it. If they watched the movie and thought that it was inaccurate, I'm not sure I would have changed it for them, with the exception of the librarian who was the victim. And it felt really important that, because she was the victim, that she didn't feel that she'd been misrepresented or that there was anything, you know, wildly inaccurate about it. And so, you know, I was nervous about showing her the movie because, you know, she is the victim of it, and what she went through was, you know, was traumatic for her. But she also felt that it was very accurate and very representative of the experience she went through. And even after watching it, she said that she felt that she had a new understanding of them, of the criminals, because I think it wasn't until that point that she was able to see them and what was motivating them. And so what was gratifying was that after she watched it, she felt that she was able to start to move on, you know, and find a kind of a level of forgiveness for them, which she'd never felt before. I think everyone loves a heist movie. I think, you know, it presents, you know, there is a sort of formula to them, which is sort of case the joint, you know, assemble the team and pull off the job and, you know, get rid of the goods or whatever it is. I think that does provide a nice structure for, you know, how you introduce characters and how you build tension and suspense and the build up to the planning and all the rest of it. But also, you know, in this case, presents a really good opportunity for subverting that genre. You know, that there's a sort of structure and a grammar to the movie where what I wanted to do was sort of mirror the character's descent into the fantasy, so that we start in a place of kind of naturalism where it's a world that we recognize and it's this sort of teenage wasteland and there's that all of the boredom There's all of the boredom of suburbia and all the rest of it. And then they find this idea, which, you know, one of them described to me in a letter he wrote from prison. It was like our version of Fight Club. You know, it was the secret that we had that set us apart from everyone else. And so the more they get into the planning of it, and the more they get into the fantasy of, you know, well, we could actually do this, you know, and this could change our lives, and, you know, nothing is ever going to be the same afterwards. And so as they get deeper into the plotting and planning, the grammar and the shape of the movie starts to kind of descend more into movie world. You know, we play with the tropes of the heist movie. The camera movement becomes slicker and more composed, I guess. You know, the idea being that as they get deeper into the plotting and the fantasy, so we as an audience descend deeper into kind of movie world with them. So at the point at which they cross this line that should never be crossed, we sort of pull the rug out from both them as characters, but also ourselves as an audience, because by this point, we've also become complicit in it. You know, we're also rooting for them to go through with it, because, you know, many of us might fantasize about crossing that line and doing this kind of unthinkable thing, but most of us are never going to do that. On one level, we're sort of rooting for them to do this thing on our behalf so that we can vicariously experience what it looks like when you, yeah, when you cross a line you should never cross, where you enter into a criminal act and you're not a criminal, or, you know, what does that look like? What does that feel like? And so I think the movie does a good job of sort of suddenly throwing you over the precipice when you suddenly realize that you've been rooting for these guys to do this thing so that we can vicariously experience that. And then they cross a line and it's not Ocean's 11. It's really messy, and it's really real, and it's really raw, and it's really uncomfortable.
There's no one else I could trust with this. You're either in or you're out right now.
How can I tell you if I'm in or I'm out without you telling me the first thing about what I might be in or out of?
I would just need you to say in principle, okay? Because this might be something not exactly legal. And there's a chance that we would have to leave everything behind.
Okay, when you say not legal,
I'm gonna say this one time and one time only. You're either in or you're out, right now.
I'm gonna need more than this one.
Not till you commit. This would be something dangerous and very exciting that I need you to be a part of. This could change everything. This is your red pill or blue pill moment, my friend.
American Animals is screening, I believe, closing night at Somerset House, which is hugely exciting. I've always been a massive fan of outdoor cinema. I grew up on and off in a little village in Spain, and one of the highlights every summer was that they would hang a huge sheet on the side of the bakery, and this ancient guy would roll up the mountain with a 1960s projector and screen movies for the kids, and all of the villagers would bring their sofas and like deck chairs out of their houses and set them up in the square, and it was like something out of Cinema Paradiso or something. And so there's something, I mean, it's weird because as a filmmaker, actually, you kind of don't want people to have these other distractions of like, oh, look, you know, can see the stars and, you know, what a beautiful sunset and all the rest of it. You want a kind of black room and everyone just watching the screen. But there is something totally magical about that. I mean, not least Somerset House, but just being outside and hundreds of people sitting around. And so, yeah, so it's great. It's really exciting.